Wargaming is sort of like golf. It is often the refuge of the wealthy, the senior leaders, and it does not get lots of play at different echelons typically. I think it is really important to have war games throughout a person's career in the service to allow them to practice decision-making.
This is The Convergence, the Army's Mad Scientist podcast. I'm Matt Sanisberg, Deputy Director of Mad Scientist, and I'll be joined in just a moment by Rachel Melling. Mad Scientist is a U.S. Army initiative that continually explores the evolution of warfare, challenges assumptions, and collaborates with academia, industry, and government. You can follow us on social media at @ArmyMadSci, or subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Today we're talking with Sebastian Bay, Senior Wargame Designer at the Center for Naval Analysis and the Faculty Advisor to the Georgetown University Wargaming Society. We'll talk with Sebastian about his views on wargaming in the military, his thoughts on the various technology evolutions, and how the DoD can better harness this unique tool. As always, the views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Army Futures Command, or the Training and Doctrine Command. Let's get started.
Today we're talking with Sebastian Bay. This is kind of a prelude to our upcoming wargaming conference here with Sebastian. So first and foremost, Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be on here.
We're excited to have you here. So we've had you on the show before, but it's always been as part of a compilation. This is kind of your first solo interview with us. So just to get started, can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a senior wargame designer at the Center for Naval Analysis, or known as CNA. We are the FFRDC for the Department of Navy, which includes the Navy and the Marine Corps. But our team, the gaming integration team here at CNA, does a wide range of work for the Joint Force, for the Combatant Commands, for the different services, and so forth. I also teach graduate level wargaming design course at Georgetown University, and we're very excited to pair up with TRADOC G2 for the upcoming Mad Scientist Conference. And I've been teaching that course for 6 years now, I think, where my students will design original educational tabletop games for often DoD or government sponsors. And I served in the Marine Corps previously and left as a sergeant in the infantry. And then somewhere from that to now, I ended up as a wargame designer.
Earlier this year, Mad Scientist conducted a crowdsourcing effort called Calling All Wargamers. And in our latest podcast episodes and blogs, we featured various submissions to this crowdsourcing effort that was soliciting for input from the wargaming community on their experiences. And you provided some compelling insights into a couple different topics surrounding wargaming, such as the significance of wargaming at different echelons, creating an ecosystem of wargames for the Joint Force, and the hurdles of integrating technology into military wargaming. So could you dive into those topics a little bit more for us here?
Yeah, so those were all like my soapbox issues. Like when you guys asked that question, I was like, oh, let me get all my pet rocks and put them in a nice pretty row for TRADOC G2 in this very long email. So the first thing I will say is that wargaming is sort of like golf, is how I explain it to people. It is often the refuge of the wealthy, of the senior leaders, and it does not get lots of play at different echelons typically. Even if you look at the wargaming ecosystem of where all the wargaming providers like CNA, like RANT, like IDA, like CAA, McWill, they're all concentrated in the NCR, and very few are outside of those. And the few that are often part of the resident PME school, like the Naval War College up in Rhode Island, like U.S. Army Command General Staff College and their wonderful educational program for wargaming out in Leavenworth, and Naval Postgraduate School out in Monterey. It is rarely ever wargaming shops and capability pushed down to the lowest echelons in the tactical force. So you don't see any of them in the company level, in the battalion, regiment, or even at the divisional level. It's only really ever really stoked in the combatant commands, and Indo-PACOM is probably the very few of the combatant commands that actually has wargaming capacity and capability there. And the reason this is a challenge in a lot of ways is because it often only serves senior leaders and it serves a specific view of the problem and only specific levers in which we are trying to adjust or tackle a problem. And I think at different echelons, you need different types of war games. And we used to know this, and we used to do it differently. The Marine Corps, as a a perfect example used to have the Tac War family of games. This is a game I've talked about a lot of times in a lot of different papers and podcasts, mainly because I think it is sort of what we thought was important to do and build an ecosystem of games. It was a series of games at different echelons that the Marine Corps designed based on the Landing Forces War game, which was an analytical that soon became an educational game later on. And it tried to institutionalize wargaming at different echelons and for different problems, because whether you're a company or battalion commander, you look at a problem very differently, right? Let's say at the time, the Soviet threat, than someone who's sitting at the MEF or the MEB or the brigade level. So these games were really designed to exercise different decision spaces. So like Tac War, which is the lowest echelon game in the series, was really focused on company and battalion combat, right? So this is what you think of like typically a war games. Like you see miniatures of tanks and little helicopters, and these guys were planning operational and tactical maneuvers, right? Combined arms, right? This is very akin to what at the time the army had, right? Which is with Dunkenf, which was his own miniatures war game, looking at combined arm warfare at the battalion level, right? And then there were other series like of that family of games. There is colloquially called the Tac War family of games, which is like Steel Thrust, Warfare, and others that looked at more command post exercise sort of structures. Because as you move through the echelons, your decision space changes and your perspective changes, and the levels and decisions you can make are different, which was important because the games would evolve as you promoted through the system as well, right? And the great thing about these family of games was that it was institutionalized across the Marine Corps down to the regiments. And each Marine Corps base had its own support network where you can literally, there was a building at Lejeune and Pendleton and Okinawa where you can go and get replacement pieces, get taught how to facilitate and all these things. But then eventually those all sort of slowly disappeared in the 90s with the Gulf War, and then vanished by the time the GWAT happened. And we have forgotten about that. And I think there's really good signs of how we're slowly returning to it with a bunch of disjointed efforts that are converging onto the target. But I think it is really important to have war games throughout a person's career in the service to allow them to practice this decision-making when they're a captain, when they're a major, when they're a colonel. And it's very different kind of decisions you're making if you're part of joint staff in the E-ring in the Pentagon, or if you're a captain, you know what I mean, in a line company.
I really like that analogy of comparing wargaming to golf. I think that's a great one. And I think it really hammers home your point on that. Why do you think it's critical for the Joint Force to have a broad ecosystem of war games that range from small, quick micro games to large in-depth war games? Does that tie back to your idea about wargaming at all echelons, or is it something beyond that?
So I do think it's related to the whole echelon thing, but it is also important because I think it is important to look at other topics beyond your typical combat kinetic centric war games, right? You're my littoral commander, right? Yeah. And the Marine Corps' OWS, its Operation War Game System, and the Army's Land Power System, they're all like about combat, right? Which is not surprising because we're in the business of combat operations, about joint operations and so forth, right? And it has the most rich decision space. You have everything from logistics, aviation, ISR, command and control, all those things. But then you leave a lot of stuff on the table that gets forgotten, right? Like, how do you do medical services, right? How do you do CASEVAC, right? There was a wonderful example of a colleague of mine down in Lejeune, who's part of the schoolhouses and does wargaming support to Lejeune and the schoolhouses on the base. And he and a couple of the Marines designed a game about water distribution. It is something that almost no war game about combat operations will ever think about. They'll think about class 3 fuel. They'll think about class 5 munitions. They'll think about class 1 food, but never really talk about water, right? So for a bunch of supply and logisticians whose job is to distribute water to forces, they made a quick and easy small game about water distribution. And I think that's amazing, right? I think not all problem sets have really rich, expansive decision spaces that require you to have big, large games. Some are perfectly designed to have small micro games that you can play in 20, 40 minutes, and that's exactly what you need, right? I created a micro game called Squadron Commander, which shows that I'm not very good with naming games, about just airplane readiness. And it's supposed to just convey how hard it is to maintain readiness of a squadron over time as things break down, as combat creates different stressors. And the game is almost not focused on combat. It is just merely a stimulus that provides you, how do I keep airplanes flying and how do I keep getting airplanes back on the ready line, right? It has a much more maintenance readiness perspective of a squadron than, let's say, a combat-oriented one. And I think that is a great way to look at different problems in the joint force that we often don't think about, right? All the way from mortuary affairs to different types of logistics or just even admin, right? Like, how do I manage talent in the force? Those are great war games to have, right? Or acquisition is a common one that we do at higher echelons. But I think it is important for us to have different types of games that look at our problem for the joint force from different angles, and not always just from a lens of combat arms, which we tend to do a lot. I think that's why we need lots of different games at different echelons, but also different formats, from the really small ones to the really large ones. And the last point about why we need sort of this gradient and ecosystem of games is that it provides on-ramps. In the early portion of my wargaming career, there were lots of lieutenant colonels, lots of colonels and O6s that I would meet at my games that were Title 10 for the Commandant, and this was their first war game. I was like, how are you in the service for 25 plus years and this is your first war game? That's like baffled my brain. And they had things that were like war games, but never really about war, like true war games with adjudication, adversarial, opponent, and adaptive decision making. So I think that is a way to slowly on-ramp people throughout their career, both on the enlisted side and also on the commissioned officer side, where they can get introduced to making decisions at different echelons, but also getting used to what games can and cannot do. I'm a big war game designer and I love games, but I am also intimately aware about their limitations. And I think as we increase gaming literacy across the force through small and big games, the bigger games, the globals, the Title 10 games, they will also inherently increase in quality as your player pool gets better, right? About what games can and cannot do, and we'll be better consumers of what games tell us about strategy, about acquisition, about the future.
That's really interesting, because it seems as though wargaming is now seen as this kind of special skill as opposed to expertise that is integrated throughout the force. And that really fits into the building of the wargaming ecosystem throughout the joint force. So next, we'd like to talk a little bit more about your thoughts on the use of technology in wargaming. Can you share what you've experienced as some of the roadblocks to implementing new technology into government or military wargaming? And additionally, some of the ways that you see to get around those roadblocks?
So I will start off my soapbox with saying, I'm all about technology. I'm usually the one on my team that is pressing us to try this new widget or this new application or this new thing I found. I'm all about it. And I think there's a lot of available commercial software, hardware. There's also a lot of freeware that we can use to increase the quality of our games. But I will say that sometimes we are blind to some of the challenges systematically across the DoD that make innovation hard with technology. And this is not only for wargaming. This is true for anything. But I'm a wargamer, so I see it from a wargaming perspective. For instance, I remember when VR and AR was coming out, and everyone was super excited. And they're like, yes, we can incorporate this into our big war games. We can have lots of immersion. We'll have a lot more detail. We'll build all these things and so forth. And my first question was like, how are you going to get it approved for the CIPR like classified spaces? Right? Like, who's going to allow you to bring this thing that is all Bluetooth enabled, that talks to each other, their headsets, into a SCIF, into a classified space? And no one had an answer, right? And I was like, cool, like, this is all great if we only run unclassified games, which is the vast majority is not, right? And that's great for like the schoolhouses and so forth. But there are severe limitations when you're trying to do it for classified settings. Even trying to use freeware like Vassal, which is a commercial like freeware system where you can play digital distributed gaming. And it's really just a very simple software where you can just like project manual games, and a lot of hobby gamers use it. I use it to play with friends, and you can send the file back and forth, but you can also play real time together at the same time and so forth. But we can't use Vassal on Nipper or any of our like extend accounts or for the Navy or for the Army, it is blocked, right? And we had to get it whitelisted to even get access to it. And there's a lot of functionality that gets broken sometimes because it tries to reach back to a server, right? The same thing with AI, right? People are like, oh, let's incorporate AI into our war games. And there's lots of questions about AI. But the first thing is like, well, you're going to train this AI on data to do a specific thing, right? You can't just pull ChatGPT off the shelf and be like, you are now the CCP and you will play the CCP in my game, because ChatGPT is not trained on Chinese literature, Chinese thought, or any of those things. You're just asking your very fancy Alexa to be like, please be Chinese all of a sudden, right? So you need to train it. So where's that data coming from? And we're really bad as an enterprise in the Defense Department of categorizing, tagging, verifying the data that we have, right? Anything from readiness to strategic policy and so forth to train AI. So you have a bad, there is a very high risk of just propagating bias, right? And propagating bad behavior into the AI and assuming it is doing the right thing in the black box, right? So bad data produces bad AI, right? And let's say we got a perfectly trained AI, right? How are you also going to get that on Zipper or JWix or any of these other systems that is designed to be closed net and not to reach out? And there are a lot of smart companies that are trying to fix that problem, right? But that is a problem that, I think it's going to have to be worked out at the enterprise level. Right now, a lot of AI experimentation in the services is happening at often standalone systems, right? Because they have to essentially avoid all the draconian requirements of like the wider enterprise, right? So that's one of the challenges, right? And then there are intellectual property and trademark challenges that we as a field will have to navigate as we use tools like AI. There are pending lawsuits against AI companies from publishers and copyright holders. Like, are we allowed to use this? Is it copyright defensible? How does that mean for us, the government, to use these things? So I think there are lots of challenges, and it's not to say we should not try, but I think we should also be realistic and pragmatic about the hurdles that exist between what we want and how we're going to integrate it. And there are some good ways to go about it, right? But it is still pretty a hard, steep road for us to get challenges. Like, I have a very good example. So I do a lot of alliance work, right? So I often work on Centrix-J and Centrix-K, which are classified enclaves of the different Japan and Korea alliance. It is its own challenge, right? But for example, I recently ran a war game bilaterally with 3MEF and Japan, and we had to move and create our adjudication tools on Excel, like hardcore R coded and Excel formulas, and off of 2016 Excel, by the way, right? Which we found out later, because our Excel was newer, had newer formulas, which broke in the 2016 version, right? But we had to do it because for some of our ORSO tools and to help a war game adjudication, we want to use them and help speed up and provide some rigor. But we had to create them all in Excel because we couldn't use Python, we couldn't use any of these other tools, which are basic, because they could not exist on Centrix, right? And we couldn't import them into Centrix, right? So like those kind of challenges, right? So if you're talking about AI, how are you going to get it as Centrix? Are you going to do a standalone system that increased costs, right? So even if like basic stuff, like, I'm creating tools in Excel, not because I want to, right? It will be easier to do in Python, right? But we can't, because I can't get it to Centrix, right? So that's one of the challenges, right? Same thing with AR, VR, and all these other things, is that there are a lot of enterprise challenges and hurdles that we need as a department, if we're really thinking about innovation in wargaming, to be like, how are we going to do these things in terms of cross-domain solutions, in terms of innovation and experimentation, and incorporating, having a clear process of how to get these technologies used?
Yeah, it's interesting because, the hurdles aren't necessarily technology hurdles. Like you said, it's more a case of friendly fire, so to speak. But the foundation for why those rules are in place, I think we understand. I mean, it's a security issue, but at the same time, there's not that agility built in for us to be able to quickly pivot to something when a solution presents itself. I would be interested, however, to see what would happen if we told ChatGPT to play the CCP in a war game. I'd just be interested to see what kind of decisions it made. I think that would be enjoyable?
To answer that question, I think it would just do what we think it would do, in the sense, I think it would just provide a mirror image of what we think China would do, right? Mainly because it has been fed on English articles, it'll reference English things, right? And it will see China and present China the way we see China and painted it for it, right? This is all about why training is important, right? About the data we have trained it to be, and it will create the version that we thought it to be, right? So there's a good story where when AI was first coming out and they were asking it to do different things and trying to figure out what the bounds of AR are. And this one, found it funny because it has a gaming reference where someone asked what a scimitar is, right? Like the bladed weapon. And there was a portion of the response that came out. You can tell it was from like a history textbook, right? It was like, it's used for this and this and that. And there was a weird little line in there. It says like, you must require +5 dexterity, right? To use it and equip it. And you're like, what the heck? But you can obviously tell it was used from like a role-playing or D&D text that AI couldn't tell the difference. It just saw the words and made these associations, cobbled them together, right? And I think that's what it would do, right? Just like with China, there'll be portions of it that sounds right because it provides the text that we have spoke ourselves, right? And then it'll mash in weird things from movies and comics and graphic novels, right? And probably even Chinese propaganda on Twitter, right? It'll mash all those things together, right? It'll create this Frankenstein version. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I think that's what it would do until we think about how to actually train it to think from a Chinese perspective, which is, I think, a deeply philosophical question, which is requires smarter people than me. But I can at least see the danger of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think your point about the mirror imaging, I think, would be interesting, too, because maybe it would be a chance for us to sort of see what we think about the Chinese fighting and combat operations, or at least give us a chance to highlight our view of them and maybe how we're training our soldiers. Maybe it kind of brings that to the forefront and says, hey, this is how we're seeing them. And this maybe necessarily isn't correct. Be an interesting thought experiment either way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you brought up in your previous answer, you brought up, you know, there's some copyright issues with some things and some lawsuits. And that brings me to kind of my next point, because we can't do this on our own. The government can only go so far. We have a lot of wargaming expertise that's organic to the military, but we have to reach out beyond ourselves. So how do you think the Joint Force and the Army can benefit from wargaming experience from academic institutions, industry, and even, as you'll see, if folks come to our conference, you know, there's a hobbyist community out there that does this just for fun. How can we reach out to them and how can we benefit from them?
As someone who increasingly straddles both those realms, one obvious one that I've thought about more and more as I went through the process for Littoral Commander and publishing it commercially, because I originally started as like a pet project for myself as a personal project during COVID. While everyone was making like sourdough bread, I remember this distinctly. Like I was like creating this game. Everyone was asking me where if I had yeast. And I was like, no, I'm looking for like glue pieces and little miniatures for my game. But the big thing I think that could be helpful, and this goes back to the whole like war games for the masses tagline, is if we took some of our own games and we gave it to a commercial publisher and be like, hey, we would like to print 1,000 copies of, let's say, the Army's Land Power game, right? Give it to a developer at a commercial, you know, publishing house for a board game and say like, hey, these are the rules, gloss them up, play test them, publish them, put it through your cycle, and we'll buy, you know, 1,000 sets and then give them out to the units, right? You can print at scale, you can do all these things, you can leverage the publishing expertise of the commercial field to get these games on scale. And we do some of this already, just in smaller ways, like Tim Barrett down at Marine Corps University is doing amazing work with his Operation War Game System, which he started at McWill when he was the head of it in the wargaming division there. But I think there can be so much more possibility. And there have been instances of where we created small batches with commercial publishers. Like even CNA had a game called A War in China Seas, which Mark Herman, I mean, commercial legend, right? Designed the game with Peter Perla, a professional legend. And like there were like maybe 15 existing copies, one of them in my house. And that's a tragedy, I think. And same thing with Land Power, right? There are very few existing hard copies of Land Power left, right? And most of them exist at CGSC, right? And there are so many interesting games that we produce for education, for analysis, that we can push out if we just partner up and just had the foresight to go all the way through a process instead of leaving lots of great games incomplete along the road. I think there are other ways in terms of partnering with other institutions. You know what I mean? There are a lot of interesting open platforms, right, about digitalization of games, as well from Board Game Arena, which is a web-based platform, to Unity, which is a game, like a sophisticated game engine, right, that, you know what I mean, like AAA companies can make games off of. There are ways for us to use these games, right? Like Nightwing Pacific out of San Diego is making a digital version off of OWS. And I think there's a lot of interest there, but like it's been slow moving because of funding issues and so forth. But I think there's a lot of collaboration and partnership that can happen between the commercial sector of gaming and the professional sector if we just allow the processes to exist and explore them in terms of technology experimentation with AR and VR. You know what I mean? The whole idea that the DoD is trying to go with digital twins, right? That can be easily applied to like AR and VR technology. We can also explore it in different ways, whether it's publishing or collaboration or for educational use. But you know what I mean? All of it's sort of still nascent, I think. But I think I have great personal hopes for that kind of partnership.
That is actually the perfect segue to talk about Littoral Commander a little bit more. Because I don't know if you know this, but we actually received a ton of submissions to our Calling All Wargamers crowdsourcing effort that spoke very highly of the game and its importance. So we'd like to ask for your thoughts on how the game came about and what you think of its role going forward, especially with the Army and Joint Forces focus on the Indo-Pacific.
So for me, Littoral Commander was a proof of concept, because initially I walked around to different commands, both in the Army and Marine Corps, actually. I was like, hey, I would like to create, you know, a force design 2030s, multi-domain task force. I use all the buzzwords required to talk to these people and be like, hey, for educational game to educate the force on these new concepts. And everyone slammed their door in my face. And they're like, yeah, we're not interested. This was back in 2018, 19. And I was like, there has to be a way for us to think about using games to educate the force at scale about these concepts, about the threat, about the operational environment, about our own force and concepts that we're experimenting with. And I wanted to create it as a proof of concept of a war game as a sandbox, right? And actually, I took some of the inspiration of like the joint capability cards in my game from the old TRADOC equipment card sets that you guys do for like Iran and China, and so forth, because I wanted them to be like flashcards, right? Because the idea around the playing cards with the poker sets is that as you were playing cards or Texan Hold'em in some FOB in Afghanistan or wherever, you will slowly just by exposure learn Iranian weapon systems, or you know what I mean, Russian weapon systems, and be able to tell the difference between a BMP-2 or a BMP-3, right? And I wanted to take the same sort of approach. And the joint capability cards in Littoral Commander are specifically designed for photos and flavor text and the actual game effect, right? So like when you looked at it, you can tell the difference between a Buk and S-500 and tell you what the differences of the different air defense systems were for the Chinese, right? The difference between a HHQ-9 and a 21, right? Ironically, I pulled a bunch of those images from TRADOC Odin's website, right? So like I wanted those to be educational tools, right? For them to play the game, see the images, learn about these capabilities, but also practice decision-making, right? I wanted it to be a beer and pretzel game where it was relatively easy to try different scenarios, play a different scale, and really be focused at the tactical, sort of high tactical, low tactical decision space, right? To really think about drones, unmanned systems, in different domains, and think about the, you know, electronic warfare thing that we didn't have to think about for a long time, cyber and long range fires and the kill chain, right? I wanted young Marines, enlisted Marines, right, to play with their, you know, officers and be like, hey, these are the ideas that us as a service, us as a joint force are tackling with, right? How do we sense far? How do we do precision fires? How do we work together as a joint force, right? Whether that's sensing with a Navy ship and shooting with the Marine Corps or Army ground-based fires. I wanted them to play with all those things. And I think the popularity, honestly, of Littoral Commander surprised me. I was like, oh, this is going to be like a niche thing for the Marine Corps for my little corner of the universe. One, I was shocked that the Marine Corps sticks to it as much as it did, its demographic and other services, right? I had a colleague of mine in the Air Force. He's like, yeah, we're using this to explain F2, T2, EA. And I was like, well, that's shocking to me. And it was shocking to me, how other countries have used it and adapted. One of the first testing grounds for Littoral Commander was actually Expeditionary Warfare School, which is like a captain's level school course in the Marine Corps, where they teach the sanctity of the MAGTF. And there was a German exchange officer there, and he was part of the first testing pool for Littoral Commander before it became Littoral Commander. And he took it back, and he and I have been exchanging back and forth via email. And he created a German version of it for the Bundeswehr, for the German army. And he created his own version based on the rule set for Littoral Commander with my blessing. And they have been using it for their own purposes, which is amazing, right? And then I think that's really the magic of it, is that to provide a sandbox and tool set that's widely available to people to be able to adapt, build, and adjust, right? I think that's really where the magic of Littoral Commander is. I don't think it's, the best war game in the world, right? But it is the first of its kind that's really breached the hole, right? Bridging the gap between a professional game that has gone fully commercial. And I think that's where has increased its accessibility, right? This is my last story about Littoral Commander. I was running a game in Okinawa recently in my professional capacity. And these two captains were telling me, hey, we've been playing this game, Littoral Commander. Our CO is really into it. We play every Friday. All the officers and young NCOs get together and play this game. It's really cool. It's about the Marine Corps, the stand-in force and stuff. And I didn't tell them it was my game. And I was like, oh, really? Tell me about it. What do you guys think about it? Do you like it? Do you hate it? Right? And it was awesome because these young Marines who are exactly the demographic, exactly in the AOR that I wanted to think about this game, and they were talking about it, and they were like, hey, we really like this card, or like, hey, we wish you could do this, we can do this in the game, and I work for this organization, and let me tell you, we can't do this, right? It was really a good discussion, and one of my young analysts ratted me out, and they're like, that's his game, right? But it was interesting to me because that's why I wanted a game that was pushed down to the captain level, down to the sergeant level, where they can have these structured conversations about the threat environment, what they think the future operational environment will look like, right? Will it be drone swarms everywhere, or will it be, cyber sends us back into the Stone Age, right? Or is it just going to be precision fires like laser beams everywhere, destroying all things, and close combat doesn't exist anymore, right? I don't agree to all those things, but I wanted those conversations to happen. And the game was a great way to start having those kind of structured conversations. And I always tell people, I'm like, hey, it is okay to disagree with the game, disagree with a scenario. For me, I fully imagine it as an educational venue for you to have these conversations. And at times, disagreements with me, the game, each other. And I think that's all added value. And my hope is that one day the services will go increasingly in that direction, right? As they try to convert big thoughts and big games in the Title 10 games down to games that can be accessible by the joint force, so that the young E5 in the army is able to understand what big army is thinking about itself in the in EUCOM and the Pacific and other places, right? So that's my big pie in the sky dream, right? To have an army version of this game, to have a Air Force version of the game, where all these young sailors, airmen, your guardians, and so forth, can really explore what their service is thinking and how they fit inside the joint force.
Well, I think that's the true test, right? There's tons of pieces of high tech kit sitting in connexes and theater because soldiers don't want to use them. The real test is if people want to use it, they will. And I think that's what from your stories, that's what's showing is you say it may not be the best war game out there, but this is what people are choosing to use. So that means it's effective. And I think that's the true testament to it. And saying that, I mean, obviously what you just said, you've been around wargaming for a while. You've been on the front line. You've been talking to people who are using the war games. You've designed them. So from your perspective, how do you see wargaming evolving over the next 10 years?
Oh, that's a good question. The first one is part of a trend and also partly hope, is there is increasing recognition across the service and the departments that we need to be more multilateral, bilateral, trilateral, more. We have to, if we think we're going to fight as a coalition in any theater, then we need to war game as a coalition. And we see this trend happening steadily, especially in the Indo-Pacific and EUCOM, where there are less and less these unilateral games where we go off to our corner, think of a plan, and then tell our host nation, like, this is our plan. And the host nation is like, wait, what? Why? No, right? There is more of these games in Korea, with Australia, with Japan, with our partners in NATO, where there are more these sort of coalition-based games where we're trying to look at this problem and war game them together. I think that is increasing. And I think that's a great trend that should continue, because I think the collaboration, the collective problem solving, is incredibly important. And that is how we get buy-in and solve the real problems, because I think we tend to have a tendency to make bad assumptions about our allies and partners and what they're willing to do and when, right? And I think these are great venues to really test those assumptions of, hey, like, I mean, what is the red line for our partners in XYZ contingency, right? Is it aligned with ours? And if it's not, how do we solve that, right? How do we plan to it, right? How do we get around it? How do we mitigate the effects of it? So I think that's a great trend that's happening. That's happening across all the services. There are more of these kind of allies and partners, coalition wargaming efforts. There's still a lot of hurdles, mainly around classification and funding and so forth. But I think it is a great way to do it. And this has been, you know, actually I'll give a shout out to the Wargaming Incentive Fund, managed by Joint Staff J8 and SAGD, because they have been really pretty forward-leaning and funding of like bilateral and coalition partner games, because they see that it has tremendous value to the department writ large, to the joint force. So they have been, you know, I mean, amazing partners to work with in that regard. So the other thing is, I do think AI is going to be part of wargaming, all right? What that role will be, I think I am more mundane and boring than other people are, where a lot of people think like AI is going to be like China, it's going to be a player, it's going to do all this like role emulation role, which I think is actually quite it's further away than the roles in which I see AI happening in the next 10 years, which is it's going to do a lot more data collecting for war games, right? Where like for any war game that I run that's like 5 days long, like I have hundreds, literally hundreds of handwritten typed like notes from discussions, conversations, decision points. And it is a huge analytical lift to lift all those things up. But I think if we are able to use AI to sort of synchronize and like cull that data, right, for keywords, key trends, and identify key things that we're trying to do, and make that sorting of data, which is boring, but I think really impactful, much better. I think that'll be one way. And I think that'll be a great way to also feed into the greater cycle of analysis and research, right, that we often talk about, where analysis feeds into games and games feed into exercises and exercises feed back into analysis, right? And I think that's a great way to use AI in that way, where you can be like, hey, I want to train you on a problem, and I'm going to feed you all the exercises and war games and things that we're doing, so you can identify trends across multiple years, right? We tend to lobotomize ourselves every 3 years, right, when we do PCSs of different organizations. And I think this is a great way to do that kind of lessons learned over a long time, right? There was a feature on Adobe where you can like summarize long text reports for you. I was reading a RAND report, and Adobe is like, hey, would you like a summary of this? I was like, oh, absolutely. And then it asked me for money, and then I didn't. But I was like, but that's amazing, right? Like that is a means of mode that it can consume information, like large text files, because it is a LLM, and you're asking it to do what it was trained to do. And I think that's really where data collection, because there's a lot of stuff on the table we leave behind when we do analysis of games, right? Because there's so much going on, right? So many discussions, so many data points and decision points. And AI, I think, can help us rack and stack those in a more systemic way to produce better analysis of the games we hold. And I think eventually people will continue to try to move into this emulation portion. But I think that first point of the mundane but powerful, right? I think the powerful things are often in the boring details, is when we are able to use that for data collection and really apply it to a cycle of learning, right? Where we can use it for exercise reports, after action reports, for learning from doctrine and so forth, and train it on problem sets that we're trying to solve as a campaign of learning. I think that's where AI can really shine as a LLM. And I think there is a move to be more digital and a move to be more incorporated back with ORSA, right? Like, I mean, back in the 70s, ORSA and wargaming used to be a pair. Many wargamers were ORSAs, operational research scientists. But in the 80s or so, they split as a community, right? Because they had very fundamental different views about problems, right? Wargamers were all about decisions. M&S were more about data, right? About like, probabilistic models and so forth. And there's this reemergence, a convergence of these two communities back again as wargamers are understanding, hey, you need some models, right? Of understanding combat relationships, detection rates, and all these things. And I think the ORSAs on the other side are realizing the human factor is a huge factor in deciding what happens in the world, right? It is not just machine on machine. And I think when we are able to merge these communities and skill sets back together in a real powerful way in the digital realm and using tools that inform wargaming with ORSA analytics, I think that's a great way to move towards. And this is a trend that we've been trying to do for like the last 10 years, right? But I think finally, we're finally getting to the point where we're making some headway to that portion as we try to incorporate M&S that is faster and more flexible into wargaming systems. The only thing I would caution against is to resist the temptation to create the all-powerful ring, right? To create this one mega war game system that will do all things for everybody for any context. Because if you create a war game system that does everything, it will do nothing, right? It will do nothing well. And you still have to keep the scope and its rules and its, you know, ability to really hone in on a problem the same. You just have to be able to be like, hey, how can I apply different tools to maintain focus on this, right? You'll never create a war game that fits all problems for all domains, all services. And I think that's just a fool's errand and you should just avoid it. It'll be a waste of money and time and effort. Just create a great game on a single problem and then move on and allow that system to continue doing that one problem, right? And I think that'll be sort of the future.
I think we all remember the cautionary tale about the one ring to rule them all.
Yeah.
Little Hobbit ended up throwing it into a volcano, so we don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Sebastian, it's always great talking wargaming with you. You're quickly kind of becoming mad scientist resident wargaming expert. So those were the heavy questions we had for you. We're going to transition now to our rapid fire questions. This is where we really judge your performance in the interview, though. We ask them, there's same three questions we asked to all of our guests. First one is, what threat or trend keeps you up at night?
The first thing that pops into my mind, which is not your typical threat, because I assume most people think about like China or robots and killer machines. For me, it is intellectual like atrophy, is I guess the right word. And I jokingly call it the PowerPointization of like thought in the service and in government, where I fear that one day when whatever crisis happens, whether it's in Europe or the Pacific or wherever, against whomever, we would have lost the critical agility intellectually to make the changes and decisions that allows us to win the war, right? It is the adaptability that I fear that we will lose because we have become so process-oriented thinkers. And that worries me, right? Where everything needs to be stop, charted. And I ask a lot of times, like, what does that tell you, like, about the conflict or about the threat, right? What is it actually informing your decision space? Or is it just a product to produce a product for a meeting? I do a lot of war games. I also attend a lot of exercises that support our war games or feed into our war games. And I see a lot of like tyranny of the process and tyranny of meetings. And I think that is a problem, right? And I think if we take those habits into a true pure conflict, we will lose. And won't have to do with any of the missiles that we have or anything like that. Obviously, those are all important. I think they're important problems. But I think buying more missiles is an easier problem than fixing how we think and fight the war and adapt to the war.
I like that. That's a unique answer. We usually don't get that kind of perspective. Question number two, what's something about you that most people might not know that you're willing to share to our few thousand audience members?
Oh, wow. I'm pretty boring in regards. But I will say I'm trying to pick up fencing as of late. It has been a hobby that I always wanted to pick up in recent years. And I finally tried. And let me tell you, fencing is a lot harder than one would anticipate. It is quite exhausting. And it is a special type of demoralizing when you lose to like an 8-year-old who's like a quarter of your size and like a million times better than you. I really like fencing because it has a hard intellectual element to it of like, you know, thinking about your moves, about how you're going to execute, you know what I mean? And people on your, my instructor calls it, intellectual chess, right? Where you're trying to plan out all your moves and counters and so forth, which only makes me feel even worse losing to these eight and 13-year-olds. But they're wicked good. But that is something that I tried to do. One thing I will say is, as a war game designer, you're like this weird, you know, convergence of analysts, of a creative person, and so forth. So one of the things I always try to do to keep the creative side of me going is to alternate hobbies and like readings between like that are related to DoD stuff and things that are like wildly different. And I think that helps me stay creative and fresh and, you know, keep a different perspective on things instead of always just reading like DoD things and national security things. I read books on cooking or try fencing and other things to allow different perspectives.
No, that's really cool. I think that's a pretty cool hobby. Doesn't the implement that you use, doesn't it have a special name?
So most people are familiar with Epee, which is the one I am currently learning. Which is like the little foil looking thing, sort of like bendy, has a pointy tip. And then there is saber, which is looks like a chunk of steel. Looks like a true sword, right? Mm-hmm. And now, oh God, my fencing teacher would be so upset that I don't remember the third one. But essentially, they all have different rules and sort of techniques. But the big difference is between the foil types, like epee and saber. Saber is much more about swinging and so forth. And cuts, while FA is more about lunging and sort of stabs and so forth. But yeah, so fencing is great. Highly recommend it. It's been hard for me to keep up with it, even this past year as I've been trying to learn because of my travel schedule, but it's something I really enjoy.
Very cool. So we got epee, saber, and scimitar into the interview.
Yes, right? Plus 5 dexterity.
There you go. All right. Finally, and we had some references to film already, but what's your favorite movie?
Oh, man. My favorite movie changes, but I would say the one I consistently go back to is probably Fight Club for various of reasons. One, I love the book series, like you know, his books that Fight Club was based on. And I actually found the books after the movie, which was interesting. But I also loved it because of its storytelling about how, apologies for all the spoilers. So if you've never watched Fight Club, I apologize. Is that when you realize Tyler Durden is just him and he's projecting that persona. And you see these moments where he is just talking to himself and it's great storytelling, right? And I think that really changed me. I think also the notion of what is to be, how do you define a generation and generation of masculinity was a very interesting topic to me growing up. And I mean, the Fight Club motif has been used a lot of times in the wargaming community about like we're going to do mental fight clubs, you know what I mean? You're going to try to train ourselves up to be, have these reps and sets, you know what I mean? And sort of thing. So that's interesting to me as well. But you know what I mean? I always like stories that have those sort of twists, right? Whether that's like Inception or Fight Club that have these sort of perspectives that are, you see the story one way and then there is some kind of reveal or twist that switches your paradigm. And I think those are always interesting to me as a game designer of the stories we tell with our games as well.
That's a great pick. It's one of my favorites as well. It had a profound effect on me when I was in high school, which I think is probably high school and maybe a little bit into the early adulthood is probably the prime demographic for that film. So, yeah, right up there with you. Sebastian, great conversation. Really appreciate you making the time. I know you're overseas right now, and it's the witching hour. So really appreciate you coming on and talking to us. If you'd like to hear and see more of Sebastian, check out our conference coming up in November, the 6th and the 7th at Georgetown University. It's Game On, Wargaming and the Operational Environment. Sebastian has been helping us put that together. He's going to be there. Look for the registration information on the MadSci blog. Keep up to date with us on social media, and you can find out all the information you need to. So once again, Sebastian, thank you so much for coming on and talking wargaming with us.
It was a pleasure, and always happy to come back.
Thanks for listening to The Convergence. I'd like to thank our guest, Sebastian Bay. You can follow us on social media at Army MadSci, and don't forget to subscribe to the blog, The Mad Scientist Laboratory, at madsciblog.tradoc.army.mil. Finally, if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a rating or review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you accessed it. This feedback helps us improve future episodes of The Convergence and allows us to reach a bigger and broader audience.